Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. The information will be right there. It is a credit union. It belongs to you. It's not a bank. And we are joined this hour, once again, every month he joins us here in the studio, Dr. Lester Spence, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, author of the new book, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. He'll be coming on soon just to talk about that book and nothing else. We haven't done that yet. It just came out. We will. And we're also joined by Dr. Aparna Mathur. Did I say, is it Mathur or Mathur?
Mathur.
Good. Mathur. Thank you. Aparna Mathur, who is an economist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And welcome, Aparna and Lester. Good to have you both with us.
Oh, good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can join us at steinershow@gmail.com with an email thought as well. Log on to one of our Facebook pages and write your questions there and ideas there, and we'll get them on the air any way you want to join us. We'd love to have you with us. So here we're going to here we are facing a situation in the United States of America of huge unemployment. Finally, the political world is beginning to talk about unemployment in America. Depending on how you look at it, there's some analyses coming out and kind of an apolitical analysis that gathers more information than just unemployment, but counts the number of people who need employment in America. And their numbers rise to 22.5% of the American population. Who would fit into that category. That would be 34 million people in need of work in America, really in need of work. So what do you do? And where do we go? And I'd just like you both to kind of talk about that for a minute. The president will be speaking about that on Thursday night, so we'll be covering it again next Monday. Number here is 410-319-8888. And Aparna Mathur, please, why don't you start?
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
I think one of the biggest problems with the current recession as opposed to previous recessions has been the increase in the long-term unemployed. So we've seen the long-term unemployed defined as those who've been out of a job for 6 months or longer as a fraction of the labor force is today at about 4%, which is at an all-time high. The previous peak in 1983 was at about 2.5%. So I think one of the biggest things we need to do today is address the issue of the long-term unemployed. And in this respect, I think there are two programs that I would hope that the president would sort of talk about in his job speech. The first is the German work sharing program, which basically allows people to keep their jobs, but the firms cut down on the number of hours that are supplied, and they pay them a lower wage. And 60% of the lost income is then reimbursed by the government through their unemployment benefits program. So the advantage of having such a program in the U.S. would be, again, that, you know, instead of laying off people, you actually keep people on the payroll, but the cost to the firm is reduced. And at the same time, the firm doesn't have to incur the cost of hiring and training new workers. So I believe that's potential job creation program to a certain extent that could work in the U.S. at this time. The other thing is what's popularly known as the Georgia Works Program, which basically provides the unemployed a prospect for receiving employment at a firm for about 6 weeks and being paid a stipend and, you know, given some amount of income. And at the end of the 6 weeks, the firm has the option of hiring the workers again. Hiring the workers that they have trained. And this program has been shown to be, you know, quite successful. About 60% of the people who have gone through the program have actually been reemployed within 90 days, which I think is a big success rate. And aside from these sort of more particular programs, I think, at a broader level, just doing something like a corporate tax rate reduction would be, something that should be on the cards, because I believe the U.S. today has one of the highest corporate tax rates in the developed world, and we're losing a lot of investment and jobs, and we're making the chances that workers can get hired in the U.S. a lot tougher as a result of the high tax rate. And in research that we've done at AEI, we've shown that high corporate taxes are actually borne by workers. So if we could actually come up with a deal that lowers the corporate tax rate and gets capital back to the U.S., I think we would be on the path to recovery faster. Thank you.
Lester.
I think those first two ideas are actually pretty good ideas. It's the third one I would challenge a bit. Because we have one of the highest corporate tax rates on paper, but in actuality, our effective tax rates, that's the rates corporations actually pay, they're really, really low. And it's not clear that reducing the real tax rate would then lead to more employment, right? They're already pretty much, effectively, they're already as low as they could be, and corporations aren't really making any moves as far as increasing the number of employed. I think a third move then would be the government to actually borrow money, given how low rates are, to put that in infrastructure development and a whole host of other activities that we can use to put people to work rebuilding the country. Even if you just think about something as roads, right? You're talking about literally billions and billions in infrastructure work. Like, I remember, around the same time, the same year Katrina hit, a bridge collapsed in Minnesota, a highway bridge collapsed in Minnesota, just because it was overused and it hadn't been replaced, right? It wasn't like there was any type of disaster, man-made or otherwise. It just fell apart because of disuse. So I would talk about significant investment in infrastructure development, significant resources given to states so states can keep people can keep their state workers employed. But then finally, I would get us to think a little bit more, and I don't have a policy prescription about this necessarily, but I would get us to think a little bit more about the concept of leisure. And this relates to the economist's idea of us reducing the number of hours we work in exchange to giving those hours to another population. Workers in the United States, particularly given their productivity, are more worked than any other similar population. They're exceedingly overworked. And I think that there's an argument to be made that this level of work that we're putting in, we're not receiving, not only are we not receiving the monetary returns, psychically and socially, we're actually dying a bit. So I would actually use this opportunity to not only create a number of policies that can get people back to work, but to start engaging in the conversation about what work actually means and how much of it we actually need to have for our country to be stable and for our country to thrive.
410-319-8888. Join us here. We are facing a job crisis in America, an unemployment crisis and an employment crisis. What are your thoughts about how we should address it? The president will give a major address on this on Thursday. We'll be talking about this leading up to it and next week as well, after we have a chance to digest what was said. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But let me just throw something out to you. I mean, one of the things about, we talk about jobs in America, and I was pretty shocked when I started looking at these statistics and ideas about what's going on in America. And that when this came from the National Employment Law Project, August 2011, study that they just released, that the jobs that we've lost, 73% of the jobs created since the recovery began, the ledger recovery began, have been low-wage jobs. By low-wage, I mean that they're paying between $7.51 and $13.52 an hour, which is $15,000 to $28,000 a year for a full-time job. 60% of the layoffs that have occurred in America have been mid-level jobs that pay between $28,142 and $42,973. So we may be, and the jobs we're creating are not meeting the needs of the people who had them in the first place, because they're working on a third to or more or less of the money that they made in those previous jobs. So this crisis in jobs also has to do with the kinds of work that are being developed in this country, that we are kind of falling by the wayside in terms of what we once were and maybe we can never be again. Are we there?
Yeah, and that's – so we're just talking about – it's basically –
Lester, then we'll go to Obama.
You're talking about the bad job crisis, right? So we have a kind of a proliferation of what we call bad jobs, you know, low wages, low income. I think to effectively deal with that challenge requires It requires us really that's one of the reasons why I want us to I think we should talk about labor. What does it mean to actually work, right? So part of it is about having a discussion about, you know, what do we have to do? Let's assume that we have this population now that is overtrained and under that they're working in jobs that they're not trained for or then they're overtrained for. Right. So there are a couple of ways to tinker around the edges as far as getting them in jobs that are more worth their pay scale. But the one question is it possible for this population to have a different quality of life working less hours? What will we have to do to enable someone who is, let's say, a high end manager who now has to work at McDonald's? What will we have to do as a society to create a space for them to actually produce the rate at, to produce the type of things they would have produced for society had they had that normal job, right? So that means rethinking labor. But the other part of this is we have to also rethink what a 21st century union looks like, because part of the reason why we have this phenomenon is not just natural that we have this type of that we have this distribution. It's also because unions have been gutted. They've been gutted almost wholesale. So the other part of it is saying, okay, what would a 21st century union look like to give workers like this some type of stability and some type of an opportunity to provide the way they're meant to provide?
Aparna?
I think the issue you bring up is interesting, and I think it has been discussed before, you know, this whole sort of skills mismatch thing that, you know, the type of jobs people are losing, they're probably... You know, you look for the same kind of job for 6 months, you don't find it, and so you're sort of settling for a lower wage job or something that is beneath your skill level. And you know, I'm sure that's a big thing with the current recession, with people, you know, just wanting to find any kind of job at which you know, they can make money. I mean, I know a lot of people who've been employed at, let's say, a BMW, you know, center. As a car salesman, and then, you know, now having to drive a taxi because they, you know, just to supplement their income. So I think that, you know, I think that the positive thing is that if you can at least find a job and sort of ride out the recession, I think you at least don't see the depreciation of skills that you would see if you were to just move into pure unemployment. So I think, you know, in a way, the skills mismatch issue is a big issue in the recession, but I think as long as we can get people working again, at a decent job or a job that they would be, you know, willing to settle for at least the short term, I think it's actually a positive. I don't agree with the union's issue. I don't think that, you know, this is the best time to sort of give a bigger role to unions. I think we've seen there's now lots of evidence to suggest that unionization actually acts as a disincentive or creates poor working conditions for, you know, people at the extremes of the distribution, in the sense that they're the ones who experience the, you know, the disemployment effects of high unionization. So I don't agree that, you know, having unions become more active is actually the solution, but I do think that if we had jobs programs that would target, you know, people who were just currently out of a job or who are unemployed, then we would, you know, we would see better outcomes.
I'd push you on the unions because without the with weaker unions, a larger slice of people who are unemployed will suffer. Like that's something we know, right? I mean, we productivity is higher now in some depending on how you define it than it's been in years, right? But we still have this unemployment crisis. I think that with unions, at least we can protect. With unions, we can protect security and benefits of a larger slice of workers.
But I think it's also, we also need to care about sort of the business response to unions. I mean, we had Boeing trying to move out, you know, to a non-union state simply because they, you know, to avoid the union activity in their state. And so I don't, you know, if you look at the employment effects, they're likely to be very negative. I mean, you might be right that the people who do get covered by unions and who do sort of survive, you know, where corporations are sort of fine with the union activity, you might see, you know, a slight wage premium for workers who are unionized. But I don't agree with the macro analysis that unions are in fact good for workers in general. I think there's enough literature to suggest that it's actually the opposite.
Send me the sites.
Let's get some calls and see what people want to bring up in the course of this conversation. We're talking with Dr. Lester Spence, Dr. Aparna Mathur, who is from the American Enterprise Institute, Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins University, 410-319-8888. Rob, you're on the air.
The economist is, what school of economics does she subscribe to? I mean, she certainly sounds like she is definitely anti-Keynesian economic theory. And it makes me wonder where she gets any of this information about unionization. What we've seen for the past 30 years has been a massive destruction of the unions and a massive wealth transfer to the richest 4% of the population by destroying unions that were instrumental pre-World War II, post-World War II, and throughout the up until about the 70s in creating what became the middle class. Unions did all of that. But since the mid-70s, there's been this push in the majority of the economic schools of thought that unfortunately President Obama speaks to go against Keynesian economic theory and go to a more supply-side-based economic theory, which only manages to enrich the oligarchs that are already rich and puts more and more austerity measures on the backs of middle class and the lower class people. So I'd like her to, you know, speak to that and also provide some actual data instead of saying that there are sources, because that's a cop-out. If she believes that there are sources, then cite them on air. If not, then her argument is false, and I'll take my answer off air.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. I guess we should start with Dr. Aparna Mathur. Aparna?
I can show you, if you send me your email, I'd be happy to send you tons of links to papers. It's not my research, but it's research out there that suggests that that increased unionization does have disemployment effects for people at the extremes of the distribution. And in fact, I think there's a big, you know, if unions were indeed sort of successful job creators, you wouldn't have seen the long-term secular decline in unionization in the U.S. that has occurred, as you pointed out, in the last 20 years and, you know, over the last 20, 30 years. So I think sort of the evidence points to itself. I think if even workers believed that unions were getting them exactly what they wanted, you wouldn't see unions having the old, you know, the big membership issues and problems that they're facing right now.
Well, so one of the reasons, there are a number of reasons why you have a decline in unionization, but the story you just told totally removes politics out of the equation, right? So it's not just a matter of unions declining because workers aren't interested in becoming members of unions, or it's not just a problem of unions not being able to find, to do certain things to increase their rates. It's also a matter of political decisions made by both parties, to be fair, to actually reduce the power of unions and to increase the power of corporations, who are then able to increase productivity expected from workers without at the same time having to give them any of the benefits or many of the benefits that unions would provide. So I think that one of the challenges I have with classical economics, kind of based on the classical model, the non-Keynesian model, or the neoliberal model, another way to think about it, is that they don't actually take politics into account enough. Right. Secondly, though, I think that it's clearly that it's empirically false that the number of that workers don't want unions. I think what's more accurate to say is that we've got kind of an anti-union framework within the country that makes unions harder to create. And that's more of a political consequence, again, than it is the consequence of individual level attitudes.
I mean, okay. Go ahead, Aparna.
No, I was just saying that even if you think of it as a political issue, I think you still have to question why politicians believe then that unions are, you know, that you need to sort of downplay the power of unions. I think the big reason for that is job creation and, you know, the sort of employment effects of having unions. And, you know, I think unions played a role at one time when we really had poor working conditions for workers, but I don't believe that that's the case anymore. And I think that, you know, more and more unions realize that, you know, a lot of corporation employees would prefer not to be unionized because they're getting the benefits and the wages that they would need, that, you know, that they would want anyway from their jobs. So I think the larger issue is that they're just not getting the people that they want to be a part of the unions.
When you say that unionization hurts the people at the ends of the curve, what's the slice you're talking about? How large is that slice?
It's the young and the old. I think there are studies showing that the worst off are people at the extremes of the distribution because they have more alternatives. So I can't tell you a percentage of, you know, what percentage of the labor force that is, but I know that these are actually the people who have sort of, you know, options out of employment, you know, retirement or just not working. And so that's a big chunk that gets affected. But also, you know, just I think the bigger issue is just the secular decline in the demand for unions, which I think we need to address, and which is possibly a big reason why, why people realize that they are sort of bad for job creation purposes.
I have a question for both of you about that. I mean, just in terms of the stats, numbers of people living in poverty or near poverty conditions that has grown. Again, you could say on one level very fast or exponentially in the last 10 years. But let me go to the phones here and then come back to that. 410-319-8888. Luis, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark.
Hi.
I think the young lady is onto something, and it's I know it's like complete heresy to your listeners there and perhaps to you and your other guests, but more power to her, and I'm listening. I'm listening to her.
All right, Luis, thank you so much for
being
thanks for being part of the show. Well, we like to have a diverse audience, but I don't want just single-minded people. It would be very boring to have a single-minded world and single-minded people either on the show or on the phones. Something's clearly amiss when you have – it seems something's clearly amiss when you have the growing disparity in wealth in America. What role does that play in this? The fact that – let's look in California – all of a sudden in California, you have one out of four families say they have a hard time feeding their children. And a part of that doesn't sound to me as if people are making all the, you know, doing really well on their wages. If we see this growth in numbers of people who are having less money, and actually, you know, as most the studies I've seen at least, that most of the jobs being created in America, the majority of jobs, not most, the majority of jobs being created in America are low wage jobs. They're not middle wage jobs or high wage jobs.
I think you're right. I mean, income inequality is definitely, has definitely grown over time, and you do see this big wealth disparity. And I think there are, multiple reasons for that. I don't think we can sort of go after the big guys and say, you know, they're the reason why we're sort of seeing, you know, increased poverty in the U.S. On average, I think, you know, you could argue that the average income levels have increased, even though the disparity at the same time has gone up, and, you know, there could be multiple reasons for that. I'm not sure how that sort of fits into the current debate, but you're right that, you know, income inequality is definitely a concern.
So if you look at, if you were to plot, like, income inequality, like, along a curve, I've talked about this before, right, from 1929 to 2008, I think might be one of the last years we have data for. It looks like a U, right, with really high levels in 1929 and high levels now and then low levels in the 50s and 60s. So what I'd argue happens is there are two sets of decisions, simplified. Right, there's a set of decisions that gives that that improves the ability of workers to bargain collectively, and then there are a set of decisions that regulate corporations. Right, so now there are a whole host of reasons why it is as high as it is now. I agree with Dr.
Martha.
Thank you, Martha. But where I disagree is that. It appears as if you're saying that declining unionization doesn't play a role, right? When it appears to me that if you looked at that income inequality, you looked at worker productivity, you looked at income held to a constant as opposed to just absolute numbers, you see all this productivity is increasing, worker anxiety is increasing, productivity's productivity is increasing, income is increasing. And decreasing, and then work anxiety is significantly increasing, right? I mean, I don't know how we cannot take the political decisions made in the 70s and 80s into account. Every model I'm familiar with does.
Aparna, let me get your last thought, and here we can take a break and move on. And then do appreciate you being part of the show today.
Thanks. I completely agree that there could be a lot of factors explaining the increasing unemployment. A lot of the studies have shown, the technological changes that took place in the 70s and 80s also sort of skewed the distribution. We've seen more sort of a divide between people getting more skilled and people who are less skilled, and, the wage premium sort of going up for college-educated workers as opposed to people with less education. So you could argue along a number of lines for why we've seen rising in income inequality. I just don't agree that, if we did believe that it was unionization, then the evidence would show that union activity should increase if you wanted to create more jobs, or if you thought that, average living conditions needed to be improved, then you would invest in exactly the things that you felt would get you there. And I think the decline in unionization is just a fact, and it just shows that people have sort of over time realized that we don't need the unionization to get where we need to go.
No. I mean, again, you're talking about, you're making the assumption that individual level desires are solely that people will have, if people had certain desires, they would automatically put those desires into effect, and it just doesn't work that way. Not in the real world, and in this instance, not in the real world, in part because of political decisions that are made above the level of individual workers to meet their desires.
I want to thank you so much, Aparna Mathur, for being part of our show, and hope you will join us again.
Yeah, absolutely, I would love to.
Love to have you back. Thank you so much for being part of our show today. Dr. Aparna Mathur is an economist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Lester Spence, political science professor at Hopkins and author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. We'll be back with us in a minute, as will Luis Rodriguez, who is a writer who wrote the book Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., his memoir, and is co-founder of Tia Chucha Centro Cultural and Bookstore in Los Angeles, and wrote an interesting piece in the Huffington Post called Why We Need a Deeper Dialogue on Black and Brown Relations in Response to Cat Williams' Anti-Mexican Rant. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to have a conversation, continuing with Dr. Lester Spence, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and author of the book, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. And we're about to be joined also by Luis Rodriguez, writer and activist. His book is Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., a memoir of his days as a member of gangs, and he's been working with gangs for many years, and is a writer and activist in L.A. and wrote an interesting piece in the Huffington Post that kind of inspired this idea to have a conversation with him today. We're still trying to get him on the phone, which was why we need a deeper black and brown, a deeper dialogue on black and brown relations because of the Cat Williams anti-Mexican rant that he gave. And so we just got to make sure we have his right number, and then we're going to get him on the air with us. So, and Lester, you and I, we did have this interesting kind of conversation about unions. I think we have another caller on here. Before we jump into the into the Latino number, let's she just hung up. So the union people, let's jump into it then, since all the union callers did just leave. We had a little bit of disagreement by email on this.
I think. So if you think about. The first thing I thought about was, like, in the 80s, a big thing, 80s and 90s, was the big thing was a black-Jewish relationship, black-Jewish dialogue, right? Cornel West, I believe, wrote a book about it, and particularly around events like the Million Man March, you have this dialogue about black-Jewish relationships. But what people were really talking about when they were talking about black-Jewish relationships were really the relationships between blacks and Jews in certain places, right? Because the populations there are a whole range of places in which there are large numbers of African Americans and fewer numbers of Jewish Americans, or not enough for there to be a black Jewish problem. I would actually argue that what we should be talking about black Latino relationships are important, particularly given that both populations are at the bear the brunt of most of the problems we're facing in the recession. But what we should be really talking about, are, to the degree we talk about it, are specific black Latino issues, right? Where you have large, and those, the issues to which Luis is writing about are issues that are unique to places like LA and probably like some areas in Texas, areas where there are large numbers of blacks and Latinos, blacks and Mexican Americans sharing space. But while we talk about that issue, we have to keep in mind that to the degree to which blacks actually have anti-Mexican or anti-Latino attitudes, they're not as strong as those self-same attitudes held by whites. And on top of that, they don't tend to be associated with policy outcomes that would hurt Mexicans and Latino Americans as much as they are associated in the minds of white Americans.
Well, I mean, but you hear every day on this program that every time I have a show and this comes up, it came up today during the interview with Catherine Pugh, where especially unemployed African-American workers mm-hmm. are always talking about illegal workers mm-hmm. taking their jobs, or that illegal workers – undocumented workers, people say illegal workers, are taking their jobs, and that these are jobs that are supposed to be going to African-American men. They're not going to African-American men. They're going to Latino men. It's an undercurrent you can't belie, you can't deny.
Well, so before I got on the show, I talked to one of my colleagues and good friends at University of Michigan, Vince Hutchings. He's actually done attitudinal research on this stuff. And nobody would deny that black anti-Latino attitudes exist, but the data indicates that those attitudes are not as strong as those held by whites. And then furthermore, if you look at something like immigration policy, for example, to the extent that blacks actually have what we think of are conservative immigration conservative attitudes on immigration, that's more a function of them caring about their own economic circumstances than it is based on them holding negative attitudes towards Latinos, right? So and that's a very important distinction, right? So if you take something like the Cat Williams rant, which we're going to talk about, yes, there are some people who feel that way. There are some people who feel exactly the same racist way Cat Williams does. But as far as how that influences black Latino attitudes, how that influences black policies on black attitudes on policies that are important to both populations, it's not that significant.
What do you think, folks? 410-319-8888. I want to hear your thoughts on this. I think that, you know, I think that what Cat Williams did in his rant against Mexican Americans, it just we were going to play some of it, but I think that it's we have too many things we have to cut out to play it.
yeah, it's pretty much out there.
But that there's always been this kind of distrust from the bottom up. Historically, whether you ever look at Frederick Douglass's writings when trying to bridge the gap between Irish and black workers here on the docks of Baltimore, you know, that immigrant groups and African-American population have always been at odds over jobs and the lowest rung on the ladder in America. And you see it in the gang activity in L.A. You see it increasingly in the gang activity here in Baltimore City. You see it. I mean, this is not something that's new. Even in the Poor People's Campaign in 1968 that we worked, you know, it was like an effort and negotiation to bring black and Latinos together to work in that in the PPC, in the Poor People's Campaign.
Well, you're always going to have you're always going to have challenges, and you're always going to have negotiation. But to complicate the gang issue, for example, if you look in the prisons, black gangs tend to be allied with certain types of Latino gangs. While white gangs, some white gangs end up allying with other Latino gangs, right? I mean, it's really complicated. I think we do kind of a disservice if we talk about black Latino relationships as if we can all cover them with the same broad brush. Like, yeah, I know there are callers who tend to blame Latino workers, whether documented or non-documented, for their own employment problems. But the thing is, I mean, even in Baltimore or in other areas, the areas that Latinos tend to be employed in, they're different sectors than the areas you tend to see black people employed in, right? So I mean, it's not like, for example, it's not like there are a significant number of African Americans who are employed, and I'm just talking right now, right? But in landscaping, right? It's not like you'd see a number of African Americans employed in the types of labor that particularly undocumented workers are likely to be involved in, for a couple of reasons, right? One is because undocumented workers, there are ways to pay them that you're not going to be able to pay someone who's actually in the state. And then there's ways to treat them that you're not going to treat somebody in the state. So it's not like they're competing there, because there's no way that African-Americans would take those jobs anyway, because they're citizens.
Let's open the phone and see what our listeners think. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And and I just got a note from Luis. There was a miscommunication. And my producer got through to him. I sent a note to him by email. He thought it was Pacific Coast time. He's in L.A., so we'll redo this show with Luis and have this conversation. But we'll have it anyway. We can go between unions and the black Latino world, because I think that there's real connections here.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things that he pointed out in his article was that in these battles between Mexican-American and African-American communities in L.A. and all through California and Arizona and Texas, where there was a big contingent of African-Americans who fought, who marched in this march to stop immigration across the border, that pointing out that, and I think this is an interesting history lesson, we'll just toss this out for a minute here, mm-hmm. which is that the battle in the Mexican War in the 1800s was a battle of the Southern white Americans to seize Texas, because the Mexicans had freed their slaves and the white Texans did not want to free their slaves. The Mexican War was, in many ways, a battle not just over land, but over slavery.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And that the first president of Mexico in 1821 was Afro-Mexican, was a black man, as the first president of Mexico. That's something that we talk about very much in our history.
No, we don't. No, we don't. I mean, and that points to how complicated it is, right? I mean, on the flip side of that, you've got someone like who's the president? Is the president Vicente Fox?
Vicente Fox of Mexico.
Yeah, remember he was talking about, I forgot what he said about black workers. What did he say? He said
something really racist.
Yeah, something really, really deeply racist right. about black workers, right? So, I mean, even if you look at the history of Mexico or if you look at the history of black-Latino relationships, you're going to find this really complicated stuff. So the question is under what circumstances does the conflict we have in our heads about this broader black-Latino conflict, in what circumstances do they really appear in local instances, right? So I'll give you a couple. So it's I know of a couple of are familiar with research on school systems, right? So when a school system becomes when the Latino school system, Latino population becomes large enough that they can kind of compete with black blacks in the same school system, there tends to be a competition where one group loses out over the other over administrative positions, whether you're talking about teachers or principals, right? So you can easily imagine a dynamic there where you have people kind of going at it, and then it's dealt with politically. In the case of some representatives, some of our congressional representative seats, I believe Maxine Waters' seat is one of these, where you've got these districts that are changing over ethnically from black to Latino, to the point where you've got these black representatives who are now looking not necessarily at a black competitor in the next election, but a Latino competitor in the next election. So we can easily see how in that case you're talking about competition over a scarce resource that can only be held by one person, and likely one, if not more, positions formerly held by blacks, by black representatives are probably going to turn. Right. That's an area in where we see black Latino conflict. But there are a number of other areas where you can imagine black Latino cooperation. Right. Whether it's on instances like police brutality or the stuff that police are doing to against Mexican or against Latinos in places like Arizona, we can easily see how blacks are going to are working to organize and working with Latinos in favor of expanding rights rather than truncating them.
Let's see what listeners are thinking, Dr. Spence. 410-319-8888. First Tony and then Gary Mall. Tony, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate the show. The one thing I wanted to find out is, did any of you listen to Cat Williams' interview this weekend with one of the CNN anchors, where he actually said that the reason why he said what he said, it was in response to what the Hispanic fella had said that precipitated his remarks. And I guess what Cat Williams indicated is that the heckler said, you know, this is an expletive, our country. And he said, you know, expletive, you know, F America, whatever. Well, Cat Williams then responded to that particular comment, not to all Mexicans in particular, and to that individual. And so Cat Williams was very, very clear about that. So I wanted to find out what your response is to that.
Well, I heard about the interview, yes. But I also listened to Cat Williams' rant that was forwarded to me as well. And he wasn't just talking to this guy when he said it, when he says, and I can't use all the language he used, obviously.
Right.
But oh, the Steiner Show would be gone, and EA would be fined tens of thousands of dollars, so I won't even try that.
I'm not defending Cat Williams at all, because what he said was, you know, clearly wrong, but I just wanted to know if you all heard that.
Yeah, and what he said was, you all like it over here a lot. If you all had California, you loved it, then you should have shouldn't have given blank back. You should have fought in California since you love it. Are you Mexican? Do you know where Mexico is? No, this ain't Mexico. It used to be Mexico. Now it's Phoenix. Blah, 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 blah. Do you know where you are? USA, USA. And then started singing the national anthem. You shouldn't be living in a country we won't pledge allegiance to. It went on like that. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I think that as a comic, he could have handled it in many ways. But I guess what I'm saying is sometimes comics can speak to the subtext of where people are. That's not always on the surface. Do you know what I mean? Because there are a lot of raw feelings in America. Yes. And I do hear what you were saying. So, Tony, what you want to say something else before we go on to the next caller? We still have Tony?
Wholeheartedly. Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm agreeing with you wholeheartedly that there is that subtext that's there. And, yes, Cat Williams, you know, he definitely could have responded differently. But, you know, given his history and who he is as a person, I'm not really that surprised. you know, it's not, and it's not an excuse, because had this been a white person who said the same thing about a black person, we would all be up in arms as well. So Cat Williams should not be given a free pass. He is responsible for the language that he used. But at the same time, I wanted to find out if you all heard what his reasons were for saying what he said.
Right.
In that interview, he did say that, you know, this individual had made these comments, and then Cat Williams, I guess, used that as a launching pad to go completely off the deep edge there.
Yeah, I hear you, and I think that and I will listen to that. Though I only read about it, but I have not listened to it. And I appreciate being part of the show, Tony.
Thank you.
A thought for your next caller?
Yeah, I just say that comics have a really great responsibility, right? And I would interpret this passage different if this were actually part of his show, right? It would be subtly different, right? Because then there'd be questions about audience and a few other questions, right? But given that he actually used this to deal with a heckler, you know, there are a number of different ways to deal. Like you said, there are a number of different ways to deal with a heckler, up to and including getting security, in some cases just getting security to kick him out. The fact that he didn't and that he uttered this, I think is telling. The question I have is the degree to which we should use this rant to talk about what black people in general feel about Latinos in general.
I agree with you completely, Lester, on that. And I think that, but it's also a way to open up a dialogue in education. One of the things we want to put on our website is both the piece that Luis wrote, and he will be on here hopefully in the next couple of weeks. We can do this in a much larger sense and invite you and some others back on. And also this connection to these other articles I've been reading, like about this Vincent Guerrero, the first black president of – I'll show you the brother's – you can't see it, but you can look at the brother's picture.
That's a brother.
The first president of Mexico.
Yeah, that's a brother.
410-319-8888. Gary Mall, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have to caution you because I want to take you back. You are in a completely different subject, even though they are related. I want to take you back to the my comment speaks to the labor unions and et cetera that you discussed earlier with the doctor who is no longer on the air.
Yes.
My comment is issue number one that I had with the comments of the doctor and her logic that she was expounding on when she was online. Number one, she spoke to issues that addresses economics and social issues. And one would hope that if somebody at a doctoral level would be quantitatively speak to those issues with numbers. And the caller who challenged her, who came and was a little bit surprised to her philosophy about the whole thing of union, did express that concern as well. And to my surprise, even after the fact, she did not even continue to substantiate her logic as to the demise of unions, in her own words, with quantitative numbers. And even the gentleman who's on the show now, I wanted her to push her, really, he did do that anyway, to be fair to him,
okay,
to show numbers that prove, you know, like her logic about unions, it's really valid. Now, my question is, she mentioned the point that unions, based on the data that's available out there, it's no longer the thing to help drive the poor people or the bottom of the economy into better positions.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I'm sorry, you have to really wrap it up.
Okay, I'm going to finish it up. My main point is, since the emergence of the BRIC countries such as India, China, Brazil,
okay,
Russia, South Africa, these countries have created a competition where the workers in the industrialized country can no longer compete with their unions for good salary that brought them into middle class, because the employing class, the elite class, have gotten a monopoly of to take their jobs over to cheap labor,
okay,
like for instance in India.
I'm sorry, Les, do you want to say something real fast?
Yeah, I'll just bring this back to the black Latino thing. I mean, you're absolutely right, and I think to be fair to her, there are a number of conservative economists who work with think tanks who are really, who when pressed find it difficult to bring up to bring numbers that support their arguments. What we're dealing with is a dynamic, and this is why I believe that black Latino thing kind of there's a way to talk about the black Latino problem that really elides that or smooths over the fact that blacks and Latinos are facing the same economic crises. And if there's any moment in which they would naturally work together, it would be now. And it would be now to work to actually improve the conditions by which unions can actually organize.
And if unions were serious, then they would be organizing with their fellow unions around the world to raise everybody's wages so they could take it all on, but they're not doing it.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And by the way, if we take part in this conference in D.C. within a month and we get union leaders on that show, we will ask them that question. But right now, I want to thank Dr. Lester Spence for once again being on this show. It's always great to have you with us, brother.
Thanks to be here.
Every month. And we'll squeeze him in here before the next month so we can maybe come back with Luis and also squeeze him in to talk about his book.
Oh, yeah, I'm with that.
We got to get your book on the air.
Yeah, got to get the book on the air.
I got it Thursday, so I now have to read it. All right, thank you, Lester. Good to have you with us.
All right, man.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. I did leave something really important out. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Now, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Cricket Aronson. Our intern is Mike Norris. We're engineered by Akisa Gunn. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, find out information about our guests and their work, visit us on the web at steinershow.org and for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.